We might have been poor, and we might have been female. Two strikes against a body in the world. But Mom knew she wasn't trash, and she knew her daughter wasn't either.
Today on KPR Presents, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. I'm Kay McIntyre. That's the title of the best-selling book by Wichita author Sarah Smarsh. Heartland received national acclaim when it was published last year, was nominated for the National Book Award, and named a Best Book of the Year by NPR. This interview was originally aired on KPR Presents on September 30th, 2018. There are many larger-than-life characters in Heartland. Your grandfather, Arnie, your parents, grandmother, Betty, but none looms larger than your unborn daughter. Mm-hmm. Tell me about August.
So when I was growing up, I was a pretty precocious kid in a lot of ways, but nonetheless, I think this is a sort of peculiar aspect of my psyche in which I had kind of a running dialogue with what I envisioned as a would-be child of my own, even at a very, very young age. And I think I kind of developed this mental trick as a way to override some of the bad programming and messaging and training that I was receiving in my environment about how to make decisions. So when I was confused about how to proceed toward my own goals or do right by myself or someone else, I would ask, what would I tell my child, what would I tell my daughter to do? And so in that way, I actually became, I was kind of a mother to myself in some ways, and maybe even to other members of my family. And that ended up being the kind of framework for this book, which is about my family, it's about myself, it's about the United States and our socioeconomic class structure. But this kind of entity correlates with that in that I am the recipient of, or the inheritor or of a legacy of teen pregnancy. So I'm the first woman, as far as I can find in any records in my direct maternal line, to not have a baby before age 20. And so I had a palpable sense that this thing that always happened to the women in my family, the teenage pregnancy, had something to do with outcomes that were related to poverty. Of course, that isn't a clear cause and effect, but in my environment, that's what I observed. And I thought, you know, I've got these things I want to do in life, and I'm going to make sure that this entity I sort of sometimes talk with never becomes manifest in the physical world.
The presence of August is a really powerful device in terms of telling your story as well.
Yeah, I can't imagine a more intimate thing to reveal. And in fact, while it was not at all contrived for the book, it was a true lived experience for me in my inner life. It didn't enter the book actually until very late in the process. So I worked on this thing for 15 years, believe it or not. And you know, some of the passages weren't quite clicking together. Different, my more journalistic voice and the very personal passages about my family. Some things just weren't quite gelling, and I realized that I was, in some ways, still kind of keeping the reader at arm's length. There was a kind of formality that wasn't allowing the narrative to flow. And then when I thought, like, oh, this conversation I've had inside myself for so long, while incredibly comfortable to share, I think it lets the reader in the most vulnerable way possible. And somehow when I did that, then the book started flowing.
You write that you grew up thinking you were middle class and being surprised to find out that no, in fact, your family was poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a few reasons for that, I think. I would start with just our very clunky way of regarding or analyzing class in this country, which really for centuries has sort of denied that there's even a class structure at all when you get down to it and you examine this idea of the American dream, where even if you're born poor, if you work hard, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, then the just reward will come. That, of course, is not the case. It's a story we tell ourselves. And for that reason, we just have not reckoned with the reality of class in this country. And that means our language is lacking. So there are, I, I think are probably an absurd number of people in this country who would call themselves middle class if asked to label, and when that term wouldn't at all be accurate. So for us, you know, this was a pre-internet rural moment. We didn't even have cable television in our house. And, you know, I was a kid in the 1980s and a teenager in the 90s. And maybe just because of the technological touchstones of our class, we're kind of like behind, you know, people with more money to like buy computers and dial up internet or whatever. I had very little awareness of where I was in the kind of American pecking order socioeconomically. And so maybe that's also part of why I had no idea that how bad off we were. But also, you know, just, and there's something beautiful about this too. We almost always had plenty to eat. We had a roof over our heads. And it was like, what more do you need? Of course, we were, in the meantime, working ourselves raw to get by. But when it's the only life that you've ever known, it's very difficult to assess what is or isn't fair about it, or what is and isn't sustainable about it. It was when I was a first-generation college student at the University of Kansas, actually, and really surrounded by middle and even some upper middle class and maybe even a few wealthy kids for the first time in my life, that I started to understand, this thing that people talk about when they say poor, turns out that was us. Now, these things ultimately are so relative. I still sort of hesitate to use that word because there are people who starve. And I didn't starve. And so something about saying poverty feels strange to me, and yet that's what it was.
I think that is probably also true on the opposite end of the economic spectrum, that a lot of kids growing up under very privileged circumstances don't really give that much thought because that's all they know.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that can wreak havoc on our country because those folks tend to occupy the most powerful places and centers of our country. And so sometimes I think the inadequate policy and even media narratives that are toxic ultimately to our progress as a country are not done for malice, but just for genuine ignorance about what it means to be poor in America.
Sarah, you used the I'm going to paraphrase you here, but you say that the term white working class contains both racial privilege and economic disadvantage.
Yeah, this is a term that's been kind of a buzzword in the media for the last couple of years, particularly in political conversations. And the working class, of course, is a diverse group in racial terms and gender and everything else. This conversation about the specifically white contingent is peculiar because we're talking about, as you said, a group that both benefits from its race, skin color, and also is struggling economically. And those two things can be true simultaneously. So white skin is an advantage. If you are a black or brown person in this country, you're statistically more likely to be poor. However, simultaneously true is that population numbers being what they are, there are more poor whites just in raw numbers than any other group. And so I think that the reductive way that we talk about American identity and the way that we compartmentalize and categorize ourselves with these very pat labels makes it very hard to have a conversation with the sort of nuance that is required to really get at the reality of the ways that these things intersect.
Well, and again, going back to the idea that America doesn't feel comfortable talking about class, in your mind, what would that conversation sound like? How could we better talk about class?
What a great question. You know, I would say maybe one thing we could do is look to national discussion in places that have a very robust discussion of class. Maybe the UK, you know, they continue to struggle with inequity and inequality along those lines. But that's a place where class is really at the fore of people's identity, not just in a lived way, but also in a really self-aware way, which, you know, has its pros and cons, but it at least means that class is being acknowledged in a person's life, and And actually, I've found as a journalist that often UK-based outlets earlier in my career were the ones that wanted to publish things that American editors just couldn't fathom were worth bringing to light. And so I kind of developed a theory that there are places where this conversation has been going on for centuries. We're very young at it here in this young country, and particularly one that has told itself the class doesn't even exist. So what would it look like? I think it would be, you know, one important corrective is that it wouldn't be beholden to the people on the losing end of that spectrum to do all the hell raising about it. And this is, of course, a problem in every aspect of American injustice. It tends to be people of color who are charged with the fight for racial equality, you know, for all their white allies. Ultimately, that has been the case historically. LGBTQ rights or the women's movement. At the Women's March, while male allies are there, women are the ones most fiercely waving that flag. And so the problem with that is the people who are worn out by the disadvantage are also being, you know, I don't necessarily want to say burdened with, but given the job of fixing the problem that is hurting them, and something about that is sort of perverse. So I would say an improved class discussion would be one in which it's not just people like me saying, here's what poverty looks like. It'd be like wealthy people saying, guess what? I don't even bat an eye when I order room service at the Ritz-Carlton, and I don't even look at the price at the bottom of the receipt. Can you believe that? And that sort of ownership of wealth privilege, I think, would help us make some important progress. You know, I admire movements and activism that seek to engage people on the ground and be reverent to the wisdom who are living the experience. The Poor People's Campaign, actually, which was begun by Dr. King, has recently been kind of resurrected by a couple of political and spiritual leaders, and they make those sorts of efforts, which I admire. But ultimately, yeah, you know, there's this sort of idea in the current political conversation that specifically poor white people are somehow radically conservative or something, and that's not what I find on the ground at all. And then I write about that often in my journalism. What I see as the far greater crisis within poor folks of all stripes is non-voting or just lack of information, lack of engagement. And that's not for lack of a sense of civic duty or character or intellect or desire to be involved in change. It's just for sheer lack of resources, of time and money. And sometimes even language, you know, the way that we talk about American politics can be very erudite, and it can be preclude people who maybe don't have a formal education from totally engaging. So, you know, I think it's, I am now kind of a member of what they call the chattering class. And I think because I hold sort of a dual class citizenship, and my family is still very much in the place that I wrote about, I'm always keenly aware of how people in my media industry are having all these discussions as though everyone is also on Twitter reading all the news and totally informed. And it turns out that often people make their decisions on election day like truly based on what they heard at the small town pizza parlor and just their group and their culture and their place. When the time and information are lacking, what ends up making those decisions often is more just the human nature as a social animal, and their votes might not even necessarily reflect what they believe. So that's a problem for our civic system.
I'm visiting with Sarah Smarsh. She's the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, one of the more shocking things that you wrote about in your book was that everyone you knew someone who had died working. And in fact, your father came very close to suffering a near-fatal workplace accident himself. Mm-hmm. Tell me about his experience and how that shaped you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of, you know, when we talk about the working poor or economic disadvantage, it tends to be in kind of abstract terms that have to do with numbers and how much money is in a bank account. And often it's just a raw physical experience and a keenly dangerous one. So my dad was a carpenter and a fourth generation Kansas wheat farmer. He needed to take a side job in addition to those efforts to get by. And so he took this gig basically driving this van to industrial sites and collecting their chemical waste. And then his job through this corporation that employed him was to take that waste, say like spent oil, and dispose of it at some EPA designated site. And the apparently for some sort of equipment malfunction, the fumes of that toxic sludge essentially that he was carrying were seeping unbeknownst to him into the cab of the van, and it almost killed him. So he was hospitalized for weeks. And, you know, he was released from the hospital, but even after that, he had what they called toxic psychosis. So he was kind of in this mental haze for several years. That was hugely traumatic, of course, to him, physically and mentally, but also to our family and his marriage. And the cause of that is that a $1 billion corporation that employed him and put him in this van couldn't spare a little change to have safer work equipment. So often the manual labor that comes with that experience is not just demoralizing or exhausting, but potentially mortally dangerous.
Let's go to another workplace. You write about accompanying your grandma Betty to the Sedgwick County Courthouse. Tell me about that job and lessons you learned at the courthouse.
Sure. So my grandmother, Betty, she's my maternal grandma. She was all of 34 when she became a grandma to me, and for that reason was kind of a second mother. And that's a kind of common story for families with teenage pregnancy. And so my family couldn't afford a babysitter. And during the summers, when my parents were working and I didn't have school keeping me busy during the day, I would tag along with my grandma to her job at that courthouse in downtown Wichita. So as a woman, a very young woman in the 60s and 70s, she had worked on factory floors as a waitress in diners and, you know, very smart, tenacious woman. But even at that moment, as the women's movement was burgeoning, it was still a very prohibitive work environment for females and particularly for poor ones. And so she had never had what we would call an office job. Title IX legislation in the late 70s made way for federal funds, including grants for women to essentially become trained to take jobs in offices. So she got one of those grants and went to what they called business school. She learned how to type, file things. And so she was sort of the first person from our family to, from my close family, to land a gig where, you know, she would put on like high heels from Kmart and go through this very clean lobby to work among people who were wearing suits. And this to me was like the height of glamour. And so she ultimately ended up being a subpoena officer, very tough work of serving subpoenas to people on the streets, and then was a probation officer for a judge. And I would tag along with her in that space. And you know, it was probably just like the future journalist in me, but just by nature, I was a kid that was fascinated by the pursuit of truth. And that has a lot to, you know, in theory, in common with the criminal justice system, too. So this thing where the people were trying to dig at what happened and find some way to justice. Of course, that system has many problems. But as a kid observing that, I was just thrilled, and she would give me this legal pad to take notes during the court proceedings that I got to observe, and then I'd go back to her office and type it up on her typewriter as my report. So I think of that. I went to J school at KU, but I think of that as kind of my first reporter training.
One of my favorite moments in your book, probably because I work in radio, it's one in which you and your mom are in the car listening to the radio. Can you read that for me?
Sure. People today would call us rednecks, but I didn't hear that word much growing up. When I did, I understood it as an insult, a city person calling a country person backward or occasionally a country person calling another country person trashy. I had no idea about the word's origins back then, of course, and linguists still aren't certain. It likely refers to a white field worker's neck burned by the sun. In the early 1900s, striking coal miners took the term when they wore red bandanas around their necks in solidarity. And white supremacist politicians in the South have used the word to pit poor whites against poor blacks. Today, the term is leveraged to disparage an entire class and place. It is printed on baseball caps, even baby bibs sold at Walmart, and worn by people with seeming pride. As with other terms that have derogatory histories, reclaiming redneck, trailer trash, hillbilly, and so on is a sort of cultural self-defense, I guess. That's understandable enough. But I never would have put you in a shirt with any of those words on it. If such a trend had existed when I was little, Mom wouldn't have put me in one either. When I got to be a little bigger, there was a hit country song on the radio called Trashy Women. Once, riding with Mom in her car, I sang along with the lyrics. I like my women just a little on the trashy side. The male singer went on about how he was raised in a sophisticated, well-to-do household, but was turned on by poor women, by waitresses in tight clothes and too much makeup. Mom winced and told me not to sing that song. She changed the station. We might have been poor, and we might have been female. Two strikes against a body in the world. Mom might have looked like something that men wanted to possess, and I might have been an unwanted child. One more strike against each of us, navigating an already perilous life. But Mom knew she wasn't trash, and she knew her daughter wasn't either.
That's Sarah Smarsh reading from her memoir, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, I read your book right on the heels of reading Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of family and culture in crisis by J.D. Vance. How did his story resonate with you?
Well, you know, I'm always happy when someone who comes from a disadvantaged background gets a voice. I did take issue, more so than with his story, with the way that the national media sort of asked him to become a spokesperson for the entire white working class. And of course, he's male and wears his conservative politics on his sleeve. This seemed to play into the idea that everyone already had that every member of the white working class is a guy with roots in Appalachia who is given to conservative politics. So that didn't represent the world that I came from. And so it did not resonate for me. I also found that book to be sort of a covert political message in some ways. There's definitely a sense of, I don't know if I'd go so far as saying finger wagging, but a fixation on individual responsibility and the responsibility of a family to overcome adversity. And while that's certainly a piece of the puzzle, I hope that my story, which I don't see as a political argument at all, but just kind of a plain telling of what I observed as a kid, I hope my story shows a little more of the public systems and the social order and public good that had to do with my trajectory as someone who people would say made good.
A lot of that had to do with your education and teachers along the way that saw something special in you.
Yeah, gosh, I always tell people this is not a story of if on this ladder that we envision in the United States as having different socioeconomic rungs and the aspiration is to climb it. If I have done that in some way, it's not a story of individual triumph. It's a story of, yes, a girl who worked very hard, but who was also born with blessings that I can't take any credit for, let's say good health and a sound mind. And also, just like you said, teachers who encouraged me, who saw my intelligence and told me that I could be anything I wanted to be. And I was this ragamuffin kid in public schools in rural Kansas. While it's kind of a far-reaching statement and an inaccurate one to tell a kid you can be anything in what turns out to be the reality of this country, I believed them, and I set my eyes on places that no one from my family had ever gone, like a college campus. And so that was transformative. And then when I got to places like that college campus, it was, you know, I worked hard for those, for the scholarships I got, but yet there was that help when I applied for it and was awarded. Now I had to work my butt.
I was going to say, you worked like five jobs.
Worked my butt off to pay the bills too, certainly. But without that help, it couldn't have been a reality. You know, I'll tell you a story about from the KU campus. When I was a senior in college, I was a straight A college student, and you know, very engaged in extracurriculars and kind of an overachieving, ambitious, very young woman. I did not know what the term graduate school meant. So just the language with which we talk about places that kind of divide us along class lines, like higher education, can be utterly foreign to a kid like me who's a first generation. And there was a federally funded program on campus called the McNair Scholars Program. And their mission is to encourage first-generation, minority, and low-income students toward graduate school and then ultimately to diversify the academy. And I did end up being a professor for several years. But I never in a million years would have dreamed a dream that big for myself if that public program hadn't been available. Now, did I do the hard work to harness it? Yes. But were it not for its existence and that taxpayer money that funded it, my life outcomes would surely be very different.
I'm sitting with Sarah Smarsh. She's the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, you've written an incredibly intimate memoir. How is this book received by your family?
I love this question, and maybe because I find the answer so delightful and sweet, which is not how it always comes to pass for memoirists. So my intimate, close family members is really who I was consulting with interviews along the way of constructing this. Some of the family passages that I write are pieced together from their memories, and I wasn't even present for them. So while it's called a memoir, it's really more of a family story, and I'm kind of the guide. And in many ways, I was trying to have the writing accurately reflect their memories. Memoir, of course, is French for memory. And so the idea is this would just be all of my, you know, subjective reflections, but it's actually in a strangely journalistic sense, me trying to document theirs. And they were very generous and brave with letting me, with trusting me with their stories. And, you know, my dad is delighted with the book. My grandmother Betty, who I see as kind of the star of the book, this would show you just the generosity of her character, which might come across on the page for readers, when she read it for the first time, because she was saying, no, I don't want to read it while it was in process. She didn't read it till it was like bound as a book. And it
was too late.
yeah. And that's, you know, I don't know her reasons for that. But the first thing she said to me was, you know, if anyone had a right to say, you know, to feel somehow all of a sudden stunned or scared about being presented on the page as a character or think that maybe I didn't get something right, the first thing she said was, I'm so sorry that you as a child had such an emotional struggle. I didn't know. You know, it kills me. She just could not be a more generous-hearted person, and so I've been very blessed in that way of a family that they understand this is my work, and they understand that in many ways it's my take on things, and theirs might be different, but they respect me and they're proud of the book.
Sarah, can I get you to read another passage from Heartland?
Sure. So this is from chapter 3 of the book, which is called A Stretch of Gravel with Wheat on Either Side, and it's really about the intersection of place and class. We lived on the open prairie, so we weren't the hillbillies of the Smoky Mountains or the Ozarks. We weren't, quote-unquote, roughnecks in oil fields. Kansas had a humble tap on oil thousands of feet below the prairie, but nothing like Oklahoma or Texas to the south. Redneck and cracker didn't quite translate, since their American usage was rooted in the slave South, against which Kansas had lit many of the fires that sparked the Civil War. Slang terms for my Plains ancestors who built dwellings there from sod, the only available material for lack of trees, didn't survive in common vernacular. We were so willfully forgotten in American culture that the most common slur toward us was one applied to poor whites anywhere. White trash. Or, since we moved in and out of mobile homes, trailer trash. There's an image in popular culture of the poor white female version. A smoke hanging out of her mouth, a baby on one hip, the screen door to her trailer propped open with the other. You could say my mother was that woman, and I was that baby, and that you would have been that baby too. But, as members of all sorts of stereotyped groups know, the popular image, selected or fixated upon by someone more powerful than you, doesn't tell you much about the life. For one thing, anyone who has lived it knows that what matters less than the trailer is where the trailer is parked. Ours was in the country by my father's choice, on the land where he later built our house. The place was thought boring for being grassland, mountains and forests being the landscapes that more often inspire awe. But without hills and trees, we had a bigger sky than Montana, an unobstructed view of bright color between dark thunderclouds like nothing I've ever seen elsewhere. Those displays were so grand outside a single wide metal dwelling on wheels that it felt less like us having a good view than like God having a view of us. I could feel how small we were.
That's Sarah Smart reading from Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, your book was released September 18th. It's already been longlisted for the National Book Award.
Yes, it's quite humbling and exciting.
Do you feel like your book came along at the right time, that there's a hunger for this message?
Well, you know, I think, so as I've discussed, I started this book 15 years ago, and so I had no idea that this moment and the book would sort of find each other, but they have, and it does seem to be, I think, kind of what, I believe there's a Greek word, kairos, for right timing. And that's how it feels. I don't know. Maybe it's more just that there were so many years I couldn't get an agent and I couldn't get somebody to publish the book. Maybe I wasn't as good of a writer in those years. But I think it was really largely to do with America wasn't ready to have this conversation. And I kept knocking on the door until the country was ready. And the book was there waiting at that moment, which is now.
Well, congratulations.
This was great, Kay. Thanks for having me.
Again, that's Sarah Smart, author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. This interview was originally broadcast on KPR Presents on September 30th, 2018. We've got more KPR Presents coming up right after this.